Welcome to The Deal with Animals. I'm Marika Bell, answer zoologist, CPDT certified dog trainer, and an animal myself. This is a podcast about the connection and interaction between humans and other animals.
Right now, I'm in my Ocean Shore studio, freezing my patootie off because the power went out last night and everything got very cold. And now that the power's back on, it's taking a long time for everything to warm back up again. So I stayed warm today by driving my car to Olympia with my two daughters, which was lovely. What was not so lovely was having a listener reach out and tell me that the intro to episode 49 sounded funny. So I gave it a listen and, lo and behold, the editing software I had been experimenting with had failed and had not actually clipped the parts I thought it had clipped. So for those of you who downloaded that episode and got to hear my little background talking to myself, well, congratulations. If you would like a slightly better version of the episode, I would recommend re-downloading it for a better listening experience. Now, surprise! I'm taking a little break over Christmas, so instead of doing a full edit on a new episode, I'm bringing back a listener favorite. The episode you're about to hear is one of my favorites as well, from very early on in the podcast. It was part of the first season, and I think pertinent to this time of year, where a lot of us are promising too much and feeling like we're delivering too little. We really need to think a little bit more about self-care, and instead we're thinking about everybody else in our lives that we could help. And good for us, that's awesome. However, sometimes it can feel like a lot. Things get overwhelming and fatigue can set in. When we're in this state, we're not fun, we're not relaxed. And if you're like me, you ultimately regret not doing better. So this episode is not just for animal care workers, it's for everyone who just feels a little overwhelmed at the moment, or maybe with life in general, and could use a bit of a perspective change. This episode is about recognizing and overcoming compassion fatigue with an amazing person, speaker and cross-stitcher, Hillary Hager. The next new episode you will hear will be coming out on the 2nd of January, where we'll continue our discussion of the animal protagonist. But there will also be a couple of specials coming up, so watch out for those. There are some exciting projects going on right now in the Pacific Northwest. I'll be talking to Rachel Aronson about the Quiet Sound Project, a voluntary seasonal ship slowdown in the Admiralty Inlet and Puget Sound aimed to reduce underwater noise intensity for the southern resident killer whale's critical habitat. I'll also be talking to Sally Lawrence of the Save Coal Creek Project. This is an advocacy group started by the Issaqua Alps Trails Club. There are some important updates to this project and ways you can help out even if you don't live in the area. So listen for those two specials coming up in January, as well as the continuation of Series 6, The Animal Protagonist, where we'll be looking further into the life of our canine companions, as well as how other than human animals experience grief, and discussing whether other animals form friendships in the same way that humans do. Okay, Hillary Hager has spent the last 20 years managing volunteers in animal welfare environments and currently serves as the Vice President of Outreach, Engagement, and Training at the Humane Society of the United States. She teaches compassion fatigue workshops around the country to help provide members of the animal protection community the support and resources to maintain their own well-being while working in a challenging and emotionally charged environment. Hillary holds a master's degree in nonprofit leadership from Seattle University. Enjoy this episode and please join me next year in 2023 as we continue to ask the question, what's the deal with animals?
I love this question. What's the deal with animals?
What do I think is the deal with animals? I think the deal with animals, I think is off. They're awesome.
So, what do you think is the deal with animals?
What is compassion fatigue?
Yeah, well, so really the best way to describe compassion fatigue, I think, is to call it the cost of caring. You know, anybody who is mission-driven, anyone who's really emotionally invested in their work has this potential to sort of experience the negative complications that come from caring so much. So when people are stretched really thin, when they are really cause-focused and committed to their work, they can wind up having sort of emotional and physical symptoms that sometimes get referred to as burnout, but really is just a decreased ability to sort of maintain their previous levels of care and compassion, and can over time be less able to carry out their work in an effective way. It's also compounded, I would say, you know, there are a lot of people who do work that is not at all emotional and they can experience burnout. Like my husband sells auto body supplies and there's not a real heavy emotional toll in that work, but he definitely gets burned out. But for people who do work with animals often are exposed to the trauma that those animals have experienced. And so there's this complicating factor of our exposure, the sort of secondary traumatic exposure that we see when animals have really suffered, when they've suffered all kinds of stuff, we see it. And we also deal with traumatized people. And so our exposure to that trauma can really kind of get soaked up and affect our own experience. And then there's the trauma that the people doing this work can then they themselves experience or have experienced in their lives. So it gets really messy. But the upshot is that there's a decreasing ability to care and feel for others over time that comes with compassion fatigue.
So it happens because we care and keeps us from caring.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, what happens, I think a lot of times when people get into this work is that they're super excited, right? They're super motivated. They're super stoked. They've got all kinds of energy. They jump in wholehearted. They want to do all the things, save all the animals, do all the things. And it's not super sustainable, right? I think the most notable characteristic of people who just get started is that they say yes when they should be saying no, and they have terrible boundaries. So they try to do too much, right? And they're doing all of the things. And, you know, when you're trying to do all of the things, it's worth thinking about what doesn't get done, right? Because you don't get more hours in the day. And so sometimes we focus on these things for animals, and there's a detriment to the other things that were meant to be taken care of in our own lives, like our laundry or the cleanliness of our kitchen. And like, you know, I'm not interested in judging people who have messy kitchens, but you know, something has to come off the plate when you're adding other things on. And so we focus so intensely on the animals, have these terrible boundaries that aren't sustainable. And then eventually over time, you know, we just can't keep that up. It's not something we can do over time. And so we set unrealistic expectations for ourselves. Other people have unrealistic expectations of us. And then our performance starts to diminish. But so then we sort of try to double down, right? Like as we're like, oh, this doesn't feel good anymore. And oh, I'm kind of annoyed. And oh, this is really rough. And so sometimes we start to cut corners, or we start to avoid people, or we start to mock people or denigrate the people that we're serving. And we try to do more work. And so as we're the irony of all of this is that we try to do more. Our commitment is to doing work for the animals. And as we try to do more, we're doing it less well. And so we're actually undermining our ability to do our best work, which is, you know, this horrible cycle that people get into. They're like, well, geez, I'll take care of myself later after I take care of the animals. But their ability to do their best work for the animals is going down and down and down the longer they're not taking care of themselves. And so ultimately they're sort of, you know, sinking their own battleship or sacking their own quarterback or whatever phrase you want to use. They're getting in their own way and interfering with their own intentions to do their best work for the animals.
Hearing this makes me think of a lot of other professions and just life that this can happen in, like motherhood, healthcare workers. We're hearing a lot about healthcare workers at the moment. And I haven't yet heard the word compassion fatigue used on the news when they're talking about healthcare worker burnout right now, but I'm hearing it.
Yeah.
Like it all sounds what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's right. It's definitely not just animal care, right? Yeah. So there are, as you say, doctors and nurses right now who, you know, they have been really pushed to the limit. And I think I have been hearing it related to burnout, and it's very difficult, of course, and I think this is one of the things that's hard for people who are working with animals, is that we have this, you know, we have this commitment to our work. We have this commitment to our cause. We're very dedicated people. And there are people who like aren't on board with what we're doing, who aren't aligned with our values, who aren't doing what we think it is that they should be doing. And we hear about all the time with animal people. Like if I had a dollar for every time I heard someone say people suck, I could retire, right? It's
right.
A really common narrative. And sometimes it's because people don't value animals the same way we do. They're not doing what we wish they could be doing. And it seems like they're actually getting in the way. And, you know, with the healthcare system right now and the way that the system has been really pushed to the brink during the pandemic, I think that's absolutely right. But there are attorneys who are dealing with separated families on the border. There are ecologists who are freaking out about collapsing frog populations. There are social workers dealing with families in crisis. And so, you know, they don't have to have their hands on animals to be caught up in this. And I think what's especially noteworthy too is that, you know, I know that you're going to wish that I had a citation for this, and I wish I do too. I swear I didn't make this up, but I read somewhere, and I didn't write it down and then read it, I promise. I read somewhere that 60% of caregivers have experienced some kind of primary trauma themselves. And I remember when I first read that statistic, I thought, oh God, 60% seems really high, right? But then I started thinking about all the people I know and all the trauma there is to go around. And it occurred to me that in fact, 60% is maybe low, right? And there are all kinds of traumas that people have experienced over their lives. And in fact, we're all experiencing one together at the same time right now with the pandemic, right? And so the tricky and complicated thing about trauma is that you can't just like self-care your way out of it, right? Like you require work with a mental health professional to sort of process and deal with the trauma that you've experienced. And that's not as common. So people have these traumatic experiences that they themselves have experienced. And then they haven't done the work with a traumatologist or a therapist to kind of work through it. And then they're continuously exposed to the trauma of others. And so it can be very triggering and it just makes it even more complicated. And so what can wind up happening is that people have experiences or symptoms that mimic PTSD, you know, where they are really anxious, where they're having a hard time sleeping, where they're ruminating and kind of reliving really horrible events over and over and over in their minds that they can't get out of and really suffer. And in the ways that you would sort of expect from people who have gone to the wars and been back, right? I mean, it's really devastating. And then because they haven't been to war and they're dealing with animals, they minimize what they're feeling and they're experiencing. And they're like, well, this is just what happens when you do this work. And it is what happens when you do this work because so many of us experience compassion fatigue as we do it. It gets very normalized, even though it's not especially healthy or, you know, healthy coping that we're dealing. We all have it. So we see it around us and it seems normal, but it really is probably not so normal.
So you already talked about a few sort of, I don't know if you call them symptoms or signs of experiencing compassion fatigue. What are some of the others that people might look out for?
It's a pretty long list. But certainly, you know, inability to empathize, anger, inability to embrace complexity, right? When you want to put things into a tidy box, like things are right or wrong or black or white or good or bad.
That's a big one. I feel like I see that happening with people in animal welfare. Really right after I go to a conference or, you know, a big group of people go to a conference, say they come back with all these fun ideas and they're really excited and they've got this new set of energy and they bring it to the staff and the staff go, nope, we're not going to change anything we're doing because we can't, we don't have the bandwidth, the mental bandwidth, the emotional bandwidth to deal with change, to deal with anything, even if it might make our lives better or the animals' lives better. What we're doing now is working for us. At least that's kind of what I hear.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that's a really interesting point. I think about this a lot because I mean, you know, even when change is what you want, and even when the thing that you're moving to is like a better system and saves more lives or whatever, the thing, even if it's a thing that you've been pestering to get like a new system or a new process or new program, even when the change is good, change is hard for people, right? So that just is sort of the baseline. But I also think that in some cases, when we're making these really big changes in our process, there is this sort of response that people have that has them feel like, you know, if we're making this change now, and this is something that we're able to do, and we weren't able to do it like last year, it really makes you feel like, I'm thinking specifically, I'll just be more specific, with like TNR. When you think about,
define TNR.
Yeah, trap, neuter, and return.
Yeah.
So traditionally, shelters were, you know, trapping feral cats and euthanizing them. And for many, many years, the sort of the response was, well, look at, this is all we have that we can do. This is the best thing we can do. It's a hard life for cats out on the street. We have to euthanize these animals. And so they were just doing, you know, they were euthanizing dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of cats every week because of this was the sort of the ethic in the program. Over time, what we've realized, of course, is that TNR is really the better way to go, that if you alter cats, they are, you know, they're territorial creatures. They'll sort of defend their territory. You can create a stable population of cats. If you're doing all of the, you know, if you're neutering and spaying every cat that comes in and then taking any kittens that are born and socializing and placing them, then over time, you can have a stable population of cats. And so a lot of organizations have moved to doing that, or neutering and then releasing back into communities friendly cats that, you know, because the odds of a cat being reunited with its owner are greater when they're outside of the shelter than when they're inside, right? So all of that sounds great. But if you were a person who for years and years and years had been euthanizing cats because you had to, and now all of a sudden you don't have to, I think that I have heard from a lot of people actually that they really struggle with that because it means that they were euthanizing those cats for like, for not really valid reasons. And so because it sort of then makes them the bad guy or the villain in the story for having euthanized all those cats for years and years and years, because that was the only option, they struggle with moving to this new model. And for people who have just started in the field who didn't work in those bad old days, you know, they just are like, why are you so resistant to this? This is like clearly better outcomes for the cats, clearly a better outcome for us. But there are people who really struggle because that it means that they were unnecessarily euthanizing animals, or they were having negative outcomes for animals that could have been avoided if they had known then what they know now, right?
Yeah.
So I think there's a flavor of that in all of this. And I think, you know, when you're freaking out, trying to just put one foot in front of the other to make it through the day, it becomes very difficult to stop and look around and go, I wonder how other people have solved this problem. You know, I wonder if there's a way I could be working smarter, not harder right now, because you're just freaking out. And I think that there are a lot of us in this work who are just freaking out and just trying to get through the day. And I think that over time, you know, I've seen over my time in this field that we've really matured in lots of really important ways in this field, and including resource sharing and strategy sharing and helping, you know, other organizations helping each other to try to improve outcomes for the animals. So we're getting there, but it's really hard because the organizations that are struggling the most are the ones least likely to access those resources when they need them, because they're just in a freak out. And, you know, one other thing that I would say when I think about symptoms is anger. And I think about this one a lot, because I think a lot of times when people picture someone experiencing compassion fatigue, what they imagine is somebody who's just like crying all the time. You know, they're really sad and they're just very overtly emotional in that way. And I think some people do express their emotions that way, and I think it's appropriate. Like, crying is good for you. It can release the tension, and, you know, it's good for you to cry. There's a reason why we cry when we're upset. But it's also pretty overt and obvious behavior, right? And so if you're a person who didn't used to cry all the time, but you find that you are like crying at work, or crying when you're driving home from work, or crying when you're doing your dishes, or crying on your Monday when you're going back to work, like, most people will think, this seems new and weird. Like, I didn't used to cry all the time, and here I am crying. Like, there's something going on with me, and probably I should get assistance. But that's not necessarily true for people who are angry, right? And people who are angry, it's almost like the frog in the pot of water, right? Like, your anger is exhibiting more and more and more over time. And if you had some sort of neutral third party observer who you could ask, like, hey, what does it look like when I'm angry? They would be able to tell you, and you're not really fooling anybody. As you're saying, like, I'm not angry. Like, oh, okay, sure you're not. And so there are a lot of people who have this slow burn of anger, and they don't realize how angry they are all the time. And, you know, and I think that the people who are like crying all the time either get the help that they need by, you know, getting professional assistance or chemical assistance, or they exit the field. But the people who are angry stick around for a really long time because they don't realize how angry they are. And it's unfortunate because those are the people who wind up sticking around for a long time. So as new people come into the field, they're like, hi, I'm here to help animals.
And then they're exposed to that.
Yeah. Well, and they walk into it, it's a buzzsaw. You know, saying yes all the time and not having good boundaries and trying to do it all right when you get started is not the way to go. But neither is being the cranky, curmudgeonly misanthrope who is like, just you wait, Missy, you're going to hate everybody in 5 minutes. And I don't think we do a very good job of preparing people who have come into the field for what it looks like what they can expect, what the trajectory is, how to set up good boundaries, how to remember that it's a marathon and not a sprint. You know, and to give people the coping skills and mechanisms for being in it for the long haul. We just don't do that. It's just not a conversation we often have. And frankly, I think that a lot of organizations are structured in such a way as to really harness that beginning stage, that unsustainable, high energy, do all the things stage because everybody else is exhausted. So the new person comes in and they're all fired up, and everybody who's tired, who's been here for a while, is like, all right, kid, knock yourself out. Like, you go do it all because I'm over here exhausted, hating everybody, and I don't have the space for it. And so I do think there's a role that organizations need to play in helping to provide the structure to allow their staff to be successful over the long term and not just let them burn themselves out. And I think that too often organizations put the burden on the individual staff people to do what they need to do rather than the organization taking responsibility for the structure that they can put in place to protect their staff.
Yeah. I remember how many years ago it was now when I took the compassion fatigue. It wasn't just a seminar. It was like a whole day workshop with you. And I took a lot of that back to Washington Humane Society, where I was working at that point, and presented it to my staff and set them up in groups so that they could have, people to talk to that were not necessarily part of their own team, that they could, release a little bit of steam, but everybody would know that this was, a way to not cope, but address some of these issues. And it was really, I guess, not surprising to me, but a little eye-opening when everyone responded really well because they'd been waiting for something like that, even if they hadn't realized they were waiting for that. And some of the stories I heard come out of those conversations, like one of my staff members who said, I had no idea that something was wrong, but I have been drinking every night, like blackout drinking every night, because I've been feeling this way. And now I don't need that anymore. I can stop.
Mm.
And none of us knew that about him. We didn't know that was happening. Yeah. He was just going home and that's how he was, quote, relaxing.
Right.
But he was doing that because he was experiencing so much of this emotional burden from his work. And so it really made me in that moment realize how important this work really, really was.
Yeah. Yeah. There are things that, I mean, we can all agree. I think that the pandemic has been really terrible for lots of ways. I mean, there are a few things that have been good about it, right? Like breweries started delivering beer, which I thought was a nice, like a good bonus. The memes have been really good. We can wear comfortable pants to work all the time. That's also really good. I would say the other thing that has been really good is an increased awareness of and conversations around mental health. One of the things I really miss though, I have done compassion fatigue trainings a lot. I was doing a lot, last year's before the pandemic, I was teaching like 40 plus workshops in a year, training 1400 people a year. And I've done the workshop probably over 200 times. I've done it in 34 states, plus Puerto Rico and in DC and in Montreal and Canada, also in Nepal. So I've had this conversation in a lot of different places with a lot of different people. And I do miss doing these things in person. And I feel like I think it would be very easy for it to be very boring and to be very rote because I'm saying the same things over and over again. But it is, for me, the most fascinating part is watching people as they come into the room and watching the way that people show up in the workshop. Because it's like me watching television. It's this game I get to play where I'm like, which person fits into which role here? Because there's usually like, there's a person who's like, oh my God, thank God we're having this conversation. I have been desperate. I've been really struggling with work. I've been desperate to have this conversation. I'm so glad we're here. And they're ready to be in the workshop and they're stoked. And then there are the people who are like, well, I don't really know what this is about, but there are snacks. So, and my manager told me I had to be here. So they like roll in, they get a big plate of food and they're like, I'm just here. And then there are the people you can tell who are like, this is going to suck. I'm going to hate this. This is BS. This is going to be a waste of my time. I don't know why anybody thinks I need to come here. I don't have a problem. There are all these other people who have a hard time. I don't have a problem with this, but fine, I'll be here anyway. And they sit there with their arms crossed. And it's amazing. People are just always so true to type. It's really fascinating. So it's this little game I get to play as people are coming in. And I'm like, how's this going to fit? And then often I watch the people who came in, arms crossed, having this moment where they're like, oh, shit. Oh, dear. This isn't great. And it's also really fascinating because there are a lot of behaviors. I mean, I don't fault people for engaging in the behaviors that they feel like are going to create a buffer for them or create a little. Yeah, it's a defense mechanism. I don't fault that, but also sometimes it really has a negative impact on other people in the system. And so, you know, there's often in a group, there's somebody whose whole persona is around like, listen, I'm a bad bee. This is who I am. Like, you know what you're going to get with me. I'm going to say what it is I want to say. This is how I'm going to be. And I'm going to lay it on the line. And they're just like, this is what I do. This is how I manage things. I like give it to people no matter what they want. And it's so fascinating because there are almost always people in the group who are like, like, and I can tell that people are like scared of them. And like that mechanism works for you, but it has a really hard impact on other people who are walking on eggshells around you. So there are all these really interesting group dynamics that show up. And I think that having people in an organization, being able to be together, to have this conversation, to have a shared vocabulary, to understand the behaviors that, again, that wind up being very normalized, you know, that like the complaining and the gossiping and, you know, and the dogpiling, you know, all of the things that can happen in an organization, you know, there are symptoms that happen in an individual level, but then there are also organizational symptoms. And, you know, and so I think for leaders of organizations, it's so essential to address, because not only as a human should you like care ideally about the humans who are in your employ and to make sure that they are, you know, that they are, they have the resilience that they need in order to be successful in their work, and that they're going to be able to stay healthy emotionally and physically while they're doing the work for you. Like, that's great. But also it can have a really negative effect on your bottom line, right? If your staff is resistant to change and they are undermining your organization's mission, and there's, you know, high levels of turnover and there's a lot of negativity, that gets in the way of really caring for your mission. And so I've been invited to organizations many times by leaders who are like, listen, you know, I've been doing this for a long time and I feel like my work-life balance is really good, but I see these people on my team and they're really struggling, and I'd really appreciate if you could come in and talk to them. And it always sort of causes my little spidey senses to tingle a little bit when I hear that, because I do appreciate everybody has their own way of being, but also leaders really have a huge responsibility about how they take care of their staff. And so when the leader's like, I'm fine, but they're struggling, I'm always like, so what is it that the leader can do to really make it easier on their teams? And I think sometimes there's a disconnect. And often when I then wind up going into an organization and having the conversation, what I hear from the team about these things that they struggle with are things that really the leader could be influencing. But the leader is just like, I'm busy doing my stuff. I don't have time to take care of everybody. And sometimes they feel like they don't want to do all the handholding. And it doesn't mean handholding or coddling or keeping your staff from doing hard work. But there are things that leaders can do to create a culture and environment where people are held accountable for their own wellness, and they are created this, they're given the skills in order to take care of themselves and to have a really trauma-informed approach where people are getting the care that they need as they continue to sort of experience their own trauma and continue to be exposed to the trauma of others. And I think leaders don't always get it. They think of it as an individual endeavor. And I think it doesn't matter what your work-life balance is or how much self-care you do if you're swimming in a toxic stew, right? Like, you can't like self-care your way out of that. It doesn't matter how much of the long list of things you can do for self-care you're engaged in if every time you go to work, you're just surrounded by miserable people. It's very difficult.
Very difficult. Yes. Yeah. So what are some exercises that can help either prevent compassion fatigue or address it if it's already happening in an organization?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that...
Or within yourself.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, the trick is, I think a lot of times, you know, we're people who are, we're invested in change, right? Like that's what we are doing as I think most of us. Like we see there's a problem, we see there's an issue, we want to be a part of the solution. And so we're trying to make change. And so a lot of times the conversations that we have with ourselves or with others is like, God, everything would be fine if just X would happen or just Y would happen. You know, and you can think of whatever the thing is. If this person didn't work here, or if we made more money, or if we had more resources, or we had more space, or this policy changed. I mean, you know, fill in the blank, right? But the trick is, you know, and certainly we want to continue to make change and continue to advocate for the things that are going to help us be more effective in our work. But I also think that there is this element of trying to manage yourself, even if nothing else around you changes, right? Like if you're feeling like you're out of control or the things around you are out of control, you have two choices. One is to try to control the thing. The other is to try to control the way you respond to the thing. And And so it's hard because I can't emphasize enough. We're going to continue to try to solve the problems. I'm not suggesting anybody just surrender to them and be like, well, it's always going to suck. Look, this is it. It's always going to be terrible. We're always going to try to improve things. But what we have to do is try to figure out how to be a non-anxious presence in the face of all of these things that are going on. And so for me, there are a few different things. I mean, the first is, and this is an exercise I actually do in my workshops, where I really encourage, I ask people to make an exhaustive list of all of the things they love about the work, all of the good stuff, all of the stuff that makes their heart sing, all of the reason why they go to work every day, the stuff that feels like a big win. And I have a flip chart and I write it down and it's an awesome list. Usually it's like, you know, it's a couple pages worth of really great, you know, saving lives and reducing suffering and returning owners to their people and educating folks and matchmaking and the transformations in animals and gaining animals' trust, like all of the good stuff. And then I ask people to tell me all the stuff they don't love. And it's almost always every time it's been a longer list, it gets filled up more quickly. It's often more granular and specific. And when you look at the things side by side, often the stuff that people love is the stuff they can control, and the stuff that they don't love are the things that are out of control. So the first thing I always suggest for people is to really think about whether that list is the one they want, right? And they act like the good list is this list they signed up for and the bad list is the garbage that's getting in the way. But really all of that is the job description and it's what we're signing up for. And so I always encourage people to really think about it. Is this the list that you want? Is the stuff that comes with doing this work, the hard stuff, the stuff that happens organizationally or the lack of support from leadership or if, you know, city government or, you know, doesn't support the organization the way that it should, or if there are laws that are getting, whatever the thing is it worth it? And if the answer is yes, then take responsibility and go like, yep, I'm signing up for it. And if it's not the list you want, don't continue to work there. Honestly, there are other ways that we can help animals that doesn't involve us being miserable all the time. So that's like the big framework. Like, is this really what I want to be doing? And then from there, the thing is, okay, if this is the thing I want to be doing, then how am I going to manage myself in the face of all of this upset to be able to sustain myself? And so the first thing is around self-care. And I think a lot of times when I do my workshops, people are expecting it to just be a whole like 2-hour session on eating your vegetables and getting enough sleep. And I mean, and certainly all of those things are great. I think, certainly exercising, spending time in nature, having some kind of artistic expression, all of those things are really important. There's actually a workbook that I suggest to people to save a starfish, where you can go through and learn all of the different various strategies for self-care and how they affect our minds and bodies and what the benefit is. But the thing is that most people know what self-care looks like and they're choosing not to do it, right? They don't prioritize it and they act like the self-care is the thing they're supposed to get to after they've done the work for animals. And I think what we have to do is really sort of shift the paradigm. Like, we have to take care of ourselves first in order that we can bring our best selves to do the work for the animals. And if we are not prioritizing ourselves, we are not bringing our best selves and we're actually undermining our intention to do our best work for the animals, right? And so, like, you don't have to do all of the things. You don't have to like eat well and exercise and have artistic expression and, you know, spend time near running water and all the different list of things that we should be doing every single, like, it's not every day, but we have to change our relationship to it and acknowledge that we must take care of ourselves first. And, you know, I think that for a lot of people in this work, their narrative has to do with like, you know, we're so focused on alleviating the suffering of animals and we sometimes feel obliged to engage in our own suffering, you know, like the animals are suffering and therefore I must also suffer in order to try to alleviate their suffering.
I can't be happy because they're not happy.
Well, yeah. And also, I mean, I think there's a particular flavor of activism around bearing witness to the suffering of animals. And so, you know, like it is a part of what people feel obliged to do because animals have no voice and because so much of the bad stuff that happens to animals happens outside of people's view that they feel like they obliged to be in that space. And so their suffering is like, I don't know. It's an intrinsic part of the work. And I think, you know, people do what they do because it works for them until it doesn't work anymore. I think if that works for them, that's great. What I have experienced is that doesn't work over the long term for a lot of people. They really do suffer. And I guess what I have concluded is that I don't believe the animals would ever ask us to suffer on their behalf. They just wouldn't. And so this narrative that we are obliged to suffer for them is a narrative that we've really constructed and placed upon ourselves. It's not what the animals are asking of us. And in fact, one of the reasons why people are so connected to animals and love them so much is because of that very dynamic, right? And the sort of unvarnished love and support we get from animals in our lives. And that's one of the things that we hold most dear. So we are not obliged to suffer for them. And so we should prioritize our wellness. But there are things like, there's also trying to identify the good stuff that, and to build our compassion satisfaction, right? The antidote to compassion fatigue is compassion satisfaction. That means identifying the things that go really well. That means identifying the ways that our excellence contributes to the work around us. And, you know, many of us have not been raised in a culture that really gives people permission to sort of toot their own horn or to praise themselves than their own accomplishments. You know, we're trained, I think, to be much more modest. And, you know, if people make a compliment, we're like, oh, I don't know what you mean. You know, like, oh, everybody would do it, instead of being like, yeah, I'm awesome. I just kicked ass. Did you see that? That was really good. And so I think there's like identifying the ways that we are awesome and the value that we bring to the work, and spending more time talking about that, I think, is really essential. You know, going back to that exercise I mentioned earlier about writing the list of things that you love and that you don't love. When I ask people to talk about which of the lists they spend most of their time talking about, it's always overwhelmingly the truth for each group I've ever done this with, that they spend more time talking about the negative list. And it's like 70, 80% of their time talking about the negative list, and only, you know, 10, 20%, 30% around the positive list. And the thing is that talking about that stuff that's upsetting keeps us upset. Like, so we have the thing that we're upset about, we feel it, and we think about it, and we stew over it, and then we talk about it, and we're stressed, and then the person who's hearing it is stressed, and then they have to think about it. And really what we're doing is sort of perpetuating the upset around that thing. And I would never suggest to people that we shouldn't talk about what's hard, but I do think that we should be very thoughtful and intentional about why we talk about that stuff, and to really try to stay solution oriented and recognize sometimes we do just need to sort of vent, but venting doesn't really solve the problem. And it really does kind of spread the anxiety around. So thinking about why we're talking about things and who we're talking to things about, and really trying to address problems with the people who can do something about it, will really be beneficial. There are also all kinds of strategies for dealing with sort of acute stress, right? Like, there are breathing exercises, like all kinds of breathing exercises. There are like kind of grounding exercises and having thoughts on purpose. So there are different sort of physiological and mental strategies to help when you're having an acute moment of stress. But I would say the biggest and probably the best thing is to get help from a professional. Like, you know, and I think that there's still too much stigma around accessing mental health services in a lot of communities. And I started a couple of years ago, probably maybe 3 years ago, started really emphasizing this point in my workshops, because it became very clear to me that part of the reason why people don't have these conversations, and why, you know, when you were talking to your team about it, and people were like, geez, now we can, you know, like, we're getting permission here to talk about it, is that people just don't. And there's this a lot of bravado in this field, and like, oh, you got to be tough enough and you got to hack it. And there's judgment around people who like aren't tough enough or who can't take it, that isn't helpful or useful. And, you know, and so I always say, like, I don't know who needs to hear this, but like, there's a reason why there are professionals and there are mental health services. And, you know, they're sliding scale. The pandemic has made them much more easily accessible remotely. You know, there are the EAPs, you know, employee assistance programs that organizations have as a benefit that can help get you connected with a therapist. But since I started including that, it's been pretty extraordinary. I've had so many people, like a couple of handfuls of people, which it seems like a lot to me, come up to me afterwards and say, I think you just saved me today. Like, this is I have been feeling so terrible and I thought it was just me. And I know that I need to go get help. And that is like, it gives me goosebumps just saying.
Makes me kind of tear up a little bit, actually.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And like, I don't know who needs to hear it, but that's what mental health services are for. And there are people who are struggling, and you know, as well as I do, you know, the burden on the veterinary profession right now, and the number and the high rate of suicide among veterinarians at this point. I mean, it's really serious. The stakes are really high. This isn't just about having a bad day. It's about having having impacts that can affect our ability to just keep going in the world. And there are people who are making the decision that they can't. And mental health services are there to help with that. And I would also say, just as an aside, that for people who are, especially people who have experienced primary trauma that isn't resolved, but even just the people who are exposed to trauma on a regular basis, I would suggest actually seeking out a therapist who has experience with trauma. You know, if you just kind of get a garden variety, I mean, you always have to try out a therapist to find the right one. But if you go to a therapist and you're talking about how hard it is working with animals and the loss you experience, and they start crying over their cat who just recently passed away,
yeah, not helpful
for them about their cat. That's probably not the right, fit. I mean, certainly I feel badly that they lost their pet cat, but you know, that's not like, you shouldn't feel like you're in a position of having to comfort your therapist. So you want to find somebody who really understands and is going to be helpful, and keep checking out, checking people out until you find one that you really click with. But help is there.
Let's talk about narratives, because I think that was a really important point that I remember from the, you know, the workshop I took, and when you've kind of touched on a little bit, which is that idea that what we tell ourselves becomes our reality.
Uh-huh.
And the story that you told at the workshop was someone had dumped a dog outside of the shelter, and the staff were getting really upset because the person had dumped the dog outside the shelter before opening hours. And so everyone was, ugh, people suck. Isn't this terrible? Yeah. So tell that story. Why that story?
Yeah, well, you know, yes. So, you know, the way that I tell that story is I talk about ladder of inference, and essentially that model, it's developed by a guy called Chris Argyris, but the model there is essentially that so many things happen around us all the time. There's stuff going on all the time, and our eyes are taking in information all the time. There's all this data coming into our eyeballs. But our brain makes decisions about what things it wants to pay attention to, and what things it doesn't think are important, right? So like, you know, this isn't a podcast, obviously, but you know, if I take my glasses off right now and I ask you what color my glasses are, you may or may not be able to answer the question. And you would only know if you had actually looked at my glasses. Otherwise, they're just things that you were looking through. And I know you've been looking at me this whole time on video. So you've noticed maybe that there are glasses there, but they're like brown with a little bit of orange sparkle. I don't know if you can notice.
I know. Most
people don't. Yeah.
And most people sparkle, but it's lovely.
Oh yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of weird for me to have sparkly glasses, but whatever. So, you know, we have a negativity bias in this work that we do. And so, you know, what happens? So there's the thing that happens. And then there's the story we make up about what happens. And because we don't know all of the story, what happens is that we fill in the blanks with worst case scenario and not a lot of grace. And so the example that you're talking about, is something that did actually happen when at PAWS, the shelter here in Washington, where I used to work with a friend. And so she was often the first person to pull in the morning to the parking lot. And regularly there would be a dog tied up at the front door to the shelter, just sitting there on the steps tied to the handrail. And so because she was the first person to be there, she would get the dog and take him into the shelter and get him into a kennel and set him up with food and water and a blanket. Leave a note for kennel staff to say, hey, there's a new dog in kennel 11, whatever, and then go on with her day. And it wasn't a big deal to her, because she's like, this is an animal shelter and here's a dog. I'm just going to go get it set up. And she worked in the wildlife center, so she'd just like go on with her day. So that happened not like every day or maybe even every week, but regularly enough. It was just the thing. And then one day she pulled in at the same time as somebody who worked in the spay neuter clinic. And there was a dog tied up, and they both kind of got out of their cars at the same time and walked up to the dog. And the staff person was like, oh, God, people dump dogs here all the time. Poor dogs dumped. And it really shifted the way that Lauren related to the same incident, right? Like, so before she's like, well, this is a shelter. That's a dog. This is what we do. And it had never occurred to her that people were like dumping dogs with it. There was something wrong with the dog being there. And it really shifted the way that she related to that exact same experience. And so after that time, when she would pull up, she would see the dog tied up. She'd be like, oh, poor buddy. Somebody dumped the dog here. And it just occurred to her one day. She's like, I don't know anything about this. I have no idea what this dog story is. She went to a workshop, learned kind of about this idea, and came in one day and there was a dog tied up. So she went and put it in a kennel, food, water, blanket, blah, blah, blah. Went down to the wildlife center and said to her coworker, they're like, oh my God, you will not believe what happened last night. There was this family going up to Anacortes to catch the last ferry out of the San Juans. And they were driving through Alderwood in terrible rush hour traffic. The traffic was going so slow, they saw a dog running on the side of the highway. So of course they pulled over. They were so nervous for this dog that they were got out and were trying to like corral the dog on the side of the road. And so amazingly, like every car on the interstate stopped and all these people got out to get this dog. So they had their dog died a couple weeks ago. So they had still had a leash and collar in the car. So they were able to leash and collar the dog. And they went to hand it off to somebody because they're like, you know, had to get to Anacortes, but everybody else got in their cars and drove away. And they're like, well, crap, now what do we do? So they Googled us. They found where we were. They came over to drop the dog off, but we had just left. They were like, oh crap, what do we do? So they left the dog here because they knew we'd take care of it. But the kids were so impressed by what happened that one of them wants to be a vet and the other one wants to be an animal control officer. And Cindy, the woman she told the story to, was like, oh my God, that's amazing. How do you know that? And she's like, I don't. I just made it up. because, you know, the thing that happened is the dog being tied up. Everything else that we fill in about why that dog is there is purely conjecture on our parts. And I think most of us who have done this work for a while know that there are a lot worse things that can happen to animals than simply being dropped off at a shelter. And a lot of us have seen the things that are worse that have happened to animals. And so there's often this huge backstory, like maybe it was the best thing that could ever have happened to that animal. Maybe it was the biggest act of love that the owner could have provided for that animal in that moment. And we simply don't know. And so when we're filling in the blanks, we're like looking often to place blame. We are making up these incredible stories about people not caring. And we simply don't know. So if we can acknowledge that we don't know and we're just making up stories, I think there's value in trying to make up stories that don't make us feel like crap and that don't make people into the villains of the story all the time. And I think that there is a lot of demonizing and vilifying of humans. And, you know, are there people who suck? Sure. Does every person suck? Pretty sure they don't, you know, and even, you know, in sheltering, even in shelters where they're dealing with really huge volume of animals coming in the door, it's still just a small percentage of the total number of animals in that community. And we forget sometimes because of the immediacy of it. And really the situation for companion animals in this country is better now than it really ever has been. And we lose sight of that because we're looking at the animals that are just right in front of us and forgetting that the intake is down by millions from where it was when I started in this business. And there are way more positive outcomes for animals every day. And so it's just nice and tidy when we can ascribe terrible motives to people's behavior, when we fill in that blank, like I said, with worst case scenario. And so the trick isn't like guessing the right story. It's just acknowledging that we don't know the whole story and just going like, I'm not really sure what's going on here. And also it doesn't matter. Like the way that I am going to interact with that dog is not any different if it was rescued by this lovely family on their way to catch a ferry to the San Juans, or it is if somebody dumped the animal. It doesn't matter. I'm still just going to do what I need to do to be responsible for that animal in that moment. And so coming up with some story that demonizes the person that brought the animal to us is not serving me at all. And it doesn't serve the animal. It doesn't have any, you know, positive impact on the outcome for that animal. And so it's not worth spending time about.
One of the ones that I latched onto, because I remember hearing this all the time and, you know, working with dogs and training dogs, again, I would always see the dogs with issues, you know, because those are the dogs that need training. So, you know, or behavior modification or whatever. So, you know, people come to me with these dogs that are aggressive or are fearful, and the fearful ones, particularly, you know, when people say, oh, well, he's afraid of men because a man abused him. Right. Whenever I hear that, or he's afraid of brooms because somebody must have beat him with a broom, you know, and I hear that. And I started thinking, is that a story you told yourself? Uh-huh. You know, because often dogs are afraid of things they just don't know. So it could be that he was never beaten by a man. There was never a horrible man who beat him with a broom. He just had a broom fall down next to him one day. And that traumatized this dog.
Yeah,
or, you know, he's just never met very many men because there's so many women in animal welfare that he just didn't meet very many men. And that was true for my own dog. So, you know, people would meet my dog and my dog was terrified of everything. He was terrified of life. Unless it had me in it, because I was the only thing he trusted and loved. And so people would ask me, oh, you adopted him, right? I was like, yeah. Oh, was he abused? It's like, no, I adopted him when he was a puppy. He was at the shelter most of his life, like from 8 weeks old. Nobody ever hurt him. He was never what we would consider traumatized. Yeah. But for him, you know, he just didn't get the socialization. And that's sad. It's true. But it's not someone going around beating puppies.
Yeah. Yeah. My old dog, Stella, my heart dog, Stella, was terrified of paper towel rolls and also wrapping paper rolls. I mean, she was very scared of them. And so subsequently I would talk to her through them. You know, be like, Stella. And then it would be playtime. And then she would like run around the house and like, we'd let her kill it at the end. You know, she'd get the paper towel roll and nobody beat her with wrapping paper. She wasn't abused by paper towels. Barley is scared of the beeping from the microwave. Nobody did anything with the beeping of the mic. That's her thing. And I do understand, like, I think sometimes it can be fun to come up with those kinds of stories, but I think you have to acknowledge that you're really just making it up. Yeah. And so if you're all we can do is make up stories. And I think you could make a real, real sound argument that really all of human history is defined by us trying to make sense of the world around us and coming up with ideas of what we think is going on around us. Right. And so there are these narratives, very elaborate narratives that we've created about like all kinds of faith systems, like all kinds of all the things is what we're trying to do. And so this is what we do with us. We make our best guess, but a lot of times, again, there's this negativity bias. And so we're looking for evidence to support our worldview. And if our worldview is that people suck, then what we're doing is we're selecting the data that supports our theory that people suck. And so all of the evidence to the contrary, all the evidence of people not sucking and being totally awesome, we don't pay attention to because it doesn't support our narrative. And so what we have to do then is sort of make a point of trying to seek that out. So if our narrative is that a coworker is terrible at their job, then all we're going to do is pay attention to all the ways that they're screwing up in their job. But even with that same person, if we shift our narrative and go like, all right, I'm going to deliberately look for all the ways this person is good at their job. I'm going to seek it out. I'm going to pay close attention. I'm going to look for all the ways that they do a good job. You're going to find those too. And it can be really surprising sometimes. Like if you really think about it, like, God, I spent all my time thinking that this person was terrible. And now that I'm actually paying attention, I'm finding there are ways that they're actually doing a great job. And so, you know, I think there are ways that we can shift the narrative. And, you know, we know that there are a lot of animals in the community that we're never going to have contact with. There are animals out there having great lives who, you know, they were responsibly sourced. The people are awesome owners. You know, they are commissioning portraits of their pets, they're having birthday parties. They're all up to date on their vaccines, like super well socialized, having great lives. And we're never going to interact with those animals. And we forget that because we have these animals in front of us. And what that means to us is that all animals are suffering. Bad things are happening to animals all over the place. And it's just not true. And so, you know, there's this other dynamic too, where like I had a friend who just recently retired from the police department in Seattle, and you know, being a cop for a long time can make you pretty cynical. And he was like, everybody breaks the law. I was like, no, they don't. most people don't break the law. Like, in fact, right? Like the most people just like follow the law, don't break, you know, they're law abiding citizens, whatever, whatever. And it was so weird. Like, imagine being a cop and then being mad that people break the law. And like when your job is literally designed to interact with the people who are breaking the law. So it's, I think, a very similar thing to us, where we are putting ourselves in the space because we want to help the animals that need us. Like, oh, these animals need us. And we get there and then we're like, oh, the animals need us. And we're mad that the animals need us. Like when we're deliberately seeking out the pets in need, and then we're like overwhelmed and upset that animals need us. And it's like, we're going and seeking out the ones that need us on purpose. And then we're upset about it. And it's like, you know, it's this weird thing where in this business, we have said for years and years, you know, be responsible pet owners. If you're not able to care for the animal yourself, bring it to us. We'll help rehome it. This is a place where you can come and get pets. Like, we're here for you in the community. And then people show up with their pets and we're like, assholes. Like, what? You know, like, it's so weird. Like, we get mad at people for taking advantage of the services we offer. Like, it's very strange.
I was remembering too, on that list, of all the positives and negatives. One thing that stood out to me was that a lot of the negatives were there because of the positives. So if the positives is like, I love cuddling kittens and I get to cuddle kittens for my job every single day, it's like, well, you wouldn't have kittens to cuddle. Right. And if all of these like people didn't neuter, you know, if they all neutered, you wouldn't have any more kittens.
Yeah.
So there was some of that crossover to realizing that, you know, you did sign up for some of that because you wanted those positive things.
Yeah.
You're going to have to deal with some of those negative things. There's that
so many of those, like, yeah. I don't like dealing with ignorant people, but I like to educate people. You know, I like to see the transformations that occur in animals when they gain trust, but I don't like seeing animals that have been abused. Right. And, you know, and I'm not saying like that you should make sure that they're abused animals in order that you enjoy their transformation, but they really are linked. And so you cannot sometimes have one without the other. And we relate to that list of the negatives, like it really shouldn't be happening. And it's just this garbage. And it's like, it is the list. And I'll tell you one thing too, that it doesn't matter what's on the list, frankly. Like it doesn't matter what's on the list. It's the way you relate to the list. And you could take half of the stuff off of the list, and then other stuff is going to come on, you know, like so many organizations that have really small facilities and, you know, like older buildings. And they're like, God, it'd be so great if we could just get a new building. And then they get a new building and they're like, oh my God, everything's so far away. it takes forever. I like forget something in my office. I have to walk all the way back down the building. And then we're mad because the building's too big. That happened to me in my old shelter. We hated the old building, got the new building, and instead of chain link, we had glass kennel doors. And then we were like, oh my God, now we got to clean all the windows. Like, we're 117, by the way, because we counted doors and windows that needed cleaning on a regular basis. And it was misery making. But still, you know, like there's always going to be something. And instead of just counting on those things changing, I think acknowledging that things are going to be hard and like we're choosing hard work. We are putting ourselves in the space of this problem. And then we gotta put, you know, deal with it and deal with ourselves in it.
Well, is there a kind of or sort of personality or person that is more prone to compassion fatigue than others, and others are just are fine and they just don't have any issues?
Well, if there is, I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer to that question. If there is, I mean, I think that it has to do with building resilience, right? And it has to do with really taking care of yourself and finding the balance. And so I think that there are, you know, I've done this workshop and there are some people, you know, who are there, and I should have mentioned them earlier. There's the fourth group of people who are like, I know what compassion fatigue is. I probably don't need this workshop, but I'm going to just be here and learn because I, you know, there's sort of like this, there is a neutral group, and they tend to be people who have been in the business for a while. They tend to be people who are like on the enforcement side, who are like, yeah, I use all my vacation. I clock out, I go home. I don't think about work when I'm not at work.
People with boundaries.
Yeah. And what's amazing is there are other people in the room who are like, oh yeah, that person doesn't care about animals the same way I do. And it's like, they understand the scope of their ability to influence change. And they work when they work and they work hard. They're committed to the animals. And also they're able to like turn it off. And so sometimes those people got to that place because they had a hard time earlier in their career and they were like, okay, I've got to figure this out if I want to do this over the long term. But I do think there are some people who maybe are a little bit more hardwired to sort of recognize the scope of their ability to influence the world and who are like, look, I gotta figure out how to take care of myself. And those are people who have really good habits. They prioritize their self-care. They usually have hobbies that they spend a lot of time on. They often are into some sort of physical activity that helps relieve their stress. Not always, right? But often. And they prioritize doing those things. So many people in this business have hobbies that they used to do all the time. And then they stopped doing them because they're like, I don't know, who's got time for that? It's like, well, you do if you prioritize it, right? Like, so I think that, you know, I'm not sure about like what the psychology breakdown is of people who are more apt to succeed in this business. I think that anyone can. It's just that a lot of times, I mentioned this earlier, I think that a lot of organizations are truly designed in order to really take advantage of people's enthusiasm and energy. And so they're not appropriately resourced. They're not appropriately staffed. And then I think sometimes organizations will really weaponize the mission. And, you know, like if you cared about animals, you'd stay later. If you cared about animals, you wouldn't take your time off. If you cared about your coworkers, you wouldn't go on vacation. And it's devastating because then people are sort of held hostage in a way that's just really terrible. And maybe it's not, the people who are saying those things aren't meaning it they're not doing it deliberately, but it can become a part of the culture in ways that are really, really unhealthy. And
I remember hearing that a lot. Yes. Somebody, oh, they're going on vacation. Oh, what are we going to do? You know? And
seriously, they're leaving at the end of their shift. Like, it's 5 and they're actually leaving. And it's like,
I stay 3 hours late. How come they're staying 3 hours late?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they have lives and because they have made it very clear with their employer that like, that's the way that they're going to work. And, you know, I've recently been teaching classes that are sort of like a hybrid compassion fatigue and then also work-life balance class. And my colleague that I teach the class with tells a story, you know, when she came up, in the business, she lived in rural New Hampshire and didn't have internet at her home and didn't really have cell service. And so when she was like on her days off, she was on her days off. Like you really couldn't reach her. And so she had to make a whole plan around like what was going to happen on weekends when Lindsay's not at work because she was not accessible. And I think that has really influenced her entire career, which is to say like, she's like not available on the weekends. Like she's very clear with people about what hours that she works. She's very clear about how people need to get in touch with her when she's off. She has vacations where like, she's not checking email, not accessible by phone. Like you can just assume it's like, she's on another planet. There's no reaching her, which means that there has to be a plan for other people in the organization about what to do when she is checked out that way. And instead of like feeling guilty about being checked out, there's a plan. And I think that we don't talk about the plan. And, you know, and so for people who have come up in this business where you are on all the time, where social people are tagging you on social media and where you've got your cell phone and where you have to be on call all the time, where everybody's on call. Like it's okay to have a person on call, but not every single person in the organization has to be available at every minute of every day, right? And so it's a very different cultural thing. And her experience with getting into this business before that happened has changed her perspective. And people who've come since then, come into the work since then, are like, "That's crazy talk. How are you able to do that? That's magic." She's like, "I just tell people, like, I'll work for you, but please understand, I prioritize self-care and this is what it looks like for me. Do you want me working for you or not?" And, you know, and the answer is yes, because she's amazing.
And I bet the answer would be yes for most employers would say yes to that and actually enjoy having someone who was that clear a communicator in their employ.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think too, that like, if you are saying that in a job interview and they're like, "Yeah, not interested in your self-care," then get like run.
Yeah,
run, right? Run away. And it's so weird. It's so wild how people, sometimes it's scary to have those conversations, but very rarely do you meet somebody when you say, "Hey, listen, I'm really trying to focus on work-life balance here. And so this is what this looks like for me. Like you message me on Facebook, but I try to keep Facebook really focused just on social stuff and not do work on Facebook. So can you email me at this address instead? And I'll get back to you when I'm working." Like most people are going to be like, "Yep, sounds good." So it's not that people are deliberately trying to foil your efforts at work-life balance. Usually it's because they are trying to manage their own anxiety as they're freaking out too. And they're looking, you know, and because there's not a plan. And so making an organizational or team plan about how to handle this stuff really can alleviate some of that anxiety. And we act like, I just think there are ways that you can be deliberate and have a strategy so that not everybody's burdened all the time. And I think the other thing that I have heard from leaders and organizations is there's anxiety about having these conversations. Like I really legitimately think they're worried that when we empower people to engage in self-care, to advocate for themselves, to not overdo it, that they are going to like somehow just bug out. They're going to be like in the middle of an emergency, like an animal's on the table about to like, you know, in a really critical moment of surgery, and somebody's going to be like, "Sorry, I got to take off. I got to go practice self-care." Like, I don't know anybody who's going to do that. Like nobody's going to bug out in a really serious situation, and they're not going to like bail on their commitments to work. Like but they need to be able to ask for what they need and to have a culture where people can talk about the grief that comes with this work sometimes, where they can talk about the upset in a way that's productive and not just like venting and complaining. But you know, nobody's going to like work less. People always work too much, right? Nobody's going to take advantage of this and be like, sorry, I'm practicing self-care. And so it means I only work 15 hours a week now. Okay. But you still pay me for 40. Like nobody. Yeah.
If somebody did do that, they would have other issues with their work too.
Correct. Right.
Probably not good at a lot of things.
Yeah, that's right. So that's right. And yeah, that's right.
I mean, there's a lot that animal welfare has learned recently. You know, in the last 15, 20 years, it's changed a lot. Do you think that, I mean, there's a lot of natural disasters happening right now. Even people sitting in their own homes were being, as you said, you know, this whole pandemic is a trauma that we are sharing and going through right now. And everybody will talk about it. And then that traumatizes you more. And then the natural disasters happen. And you're hearing about people being swept away in floods. And some of that's in our country, some of it's in other countries. How do we maintain our compassion outside of what's going on in our own lives without getting burnt out from that all the time? Do you have this amazing answer?
Yeah. Well, I wish that I did. I think about this a lot. You know, I mean, again, you know, like I teach these classes, right? I teach these classes about how to build resilience. So there are a few things that I would say. I mean, so first of all is, and I find that I struggle with it. Let me finish that thought. I teach these classes and also I struggle with this myself. And I remember early in the pandemic, I knew that something was up for me. You know, I work from home, very comfortable home, very happy to be here. If I was going to have to be stuck anywhere, I'd be glad it was here. You know, and I thought with horror about all the people when the pandemic was first happening who had like rooms on cruise ships, like especially windowless rooms that they probably went cheap on their rooms because they were going to get the all-inclusive alcohol and food package. And they thought they'd never be in their cabin. And then were stuck in a windowless room for 3 weeks waiting for the quarantine to be able to get off of the boat. And I just like panic for those people. So like, I'm happy to be isolated in my home. It's not a hardship for me, but I recognized that I was having a hard time when instead of being very careful when I unload the dishwasher to sort my spoons and my forks and stack them neatly by type of spoon, I was just unloading the dishwasher. And like, I mean, they were still, I'm not an animal. I was still sorting the forks from the spoons, but I was not separating the different kinds of spoons. And I was like, okay, there's something going on. There's something going on for me here. And I realized that I needed to sort of really think about how I was practicing, what kind of self-care I was practicing. And I think that there's a lot of really interesting writing now about ecological grief that people are experiencing and that has really resonated with me. I mean, you know, here in Washington State now every year we have this sort of cataclysmic fires from somewhere, either close or far away from here, that like make it impossible to see the sun, and that makes it feel like it's the end times because it smells like smoke and there's ash falling from the sky. You know, and I remember, was it 3 years ago now when the orca had like, you know, her baby had died. She was carrying around her dead baby for like 17 days. We couldn't see the sun. And I was like, oh God. And so it's, I think, very similar. There's this loss of our way of life. There's loss of things that we used to be able to do. And grief isn't just about losing a person. It's about losing our habits, the things we like to do, the people we like to spend time with, the things that were familiar to us. And so I think the best strategy for dealing with that is to actually to engage in a gratitude practice. And I am aware when I say this that it sounds a little bit woo-woo sometimes it's hard. Like, you know, if you're like clinically depressed and you have an imbalance in your brain, this is maybe not going to be an especially helpful strategy when there's nothing to feel optimistic about or nothing to feel grateful for when you're really struggling. And so I add that caveat. But, you know, a gratitude practice can look like a few things. Like, it could be that at the end of the day, you write down three things that went especially well. You know, and three seems to be the magic number. And just every day to make a habit, like over the course of 3 weeks, just to really be focused on the things that go well. But, or to have the other model is to write every day, just to write down something that's pretty behaviorally specific for which you are grateful. So I might say, you know, I'm I mean, the easy one would be like, I'm grateful for my dog. But like what I say is like, I'm grateful that Barley was really, really, really well behaved on our walk today and wasn't as reactive to other dogs as she sometimes is, which is great because I look like a real jerk with my dog, like freaking out at other dogs on leash. That's a bad look for me. You know, or not just, I'm grateful for my husband, but I'm really grateful that John cooked dinner last night so that I didn't have to because I was feeling really exhausted. And so, you know, the research shows that people who have a gratitude practice, have stronger immune systems. They're also more easily able to express kindness and compassion. And they're also better at identifying the things for which they're grateful. And I think about that last one a lot because, you know, there have been times when I struggled sometimes to find the thing I'm grateful for. And so I've had to dig kind of deep. And so what happens then is that I kind of will save some for days that are kind of hard. You know, and so what I'm doing is if I know I'm going to be accountable for writing something in my journal, I'm like, oh, I better save that one. And I have like a little thing on my, I have a journal where I actually write it, but I also have a little note thing on my phone so I can capture the thing that I'm grateful for so that I can save it for when I need to, because I'm constantly scanning my environment for something that I could use if I need it in my notebook.
I love that you practice what you preach.
Well, I didn't for a long time, I'll be honest with you. I was like, you should totally have a gratitude practice. And I totally didn't have a gratitude practice. And so, you know, even when there is sort of all of this chaos and there are lots of things, we could spend a lot of time talking about all of the things that aren't going well right now in this country and in this world. And it can be very overwhelming. But even with that, there's so much good stuff that goes on around us. And it can be, you know, like I was grateful. I got to see a baby bunny the other day in my yard. And it was like, oh God, it's barely the size of my hand. And I was like squealing with delight. It made me so happy. And that went in because like I got to see a baby bunny. And I mean, it was ridiculous how excited I was about the rabbit. But so like there's good stuff and there's good stuff all over the place. There's so many good things. Like when the honey crisps come in at the grocery store, like that always goes on my list. Like,
my honey crisp apple tree is loaded right now. I have a whole tree of honey crisp that was here when I moved in. And so it is established.
Oh man.
I can reach, it's not very tall, so I can reach all the apples. I am so excited.
Yeah, no. And there are all these other different kinds of varieties now that's trying to capitalize on the honey crisp thing. And like, it's not happening. Cosmic crisp. Don't even try it. Give me the Honeycrisps or give me nothing at all. Fuji's are so last decade. Like I need the Honeycrisps. But I do like, I have the moment when the new crop comes in at the grocery store. I know it because it comes up in my Facebook memories where I'm like the Honeycrisps are here. It's like a day in the calendar. So I can go put it into my,
I know how to get you to come to my house.
Yes. Now. Yeah. Yeah. I'm very easily persuaded. By
I gave away so many bags of apples last year, and that was my Macintosh tree last year. The Honeycrisp produced one apple last year. It's on like a 2-year cycle.
Yeah.
So
nice.
This year it's going to be insane with the apples.
Yeah.
I'm going to make lots of apple pie.
It's gonna be so good though. It's going to be so good.
So good.
But so yeah, I would say that the gratitude practice and you know, and I think that you can actually, I think you can, it's not just like seeing things in nature, although that makes the list. It can be like the food that you made, it could be the conversation that you had, the thing that a colleague did. Like, I'm grateful that my colleague was able to be successful in XYZ thing. I mean, there's a wide range of things, but we don't spend a ton of time thinking about that stuff. And it really does feel better. And if having that practice is like one little way to inoculate myself against all of the things that are hard, then I think it's important. I think the other thing to do is to really kind of spend some time curating your own online experience, you know? And I think, especially because there is this narrative in this business about, you know, I mean, I really love to be well-informed. And so, and of course, if you're trying to pay attention to the news and the news is all bad, then you're going to get a lot of bad news. But what I also think is that, especially on Facebook in particular, there's just this like, I mean, it's this onslaught of information. And there's this very particular kind of way of being on social media that I think lines up with people's offline behavior too. Like, you know, when somebody takes a bite of something and they're like, oh, this is gross. Do you want it? And you're like, no, thanks. Right. Or like, oh, I think this is spoiled. Try it. And you're like, no, like, I don't want to do that. And I think we do that on social media a lot too, where we're like, this is an outrage, share, or this is horrible, share. And so I've started not only really thinking through what I want to share but also what I'm willing to consume. And so I like really did a cleanup of my social media and have really focused on, I mean, you see it because some of you see the stuff that I share, like it's my pets. And then also like memes,
beautiful views from your windows.
Yeah. And that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yes. Cause we're very lucky here with this incredible view. So I have really curated my own experience. And so I don't watch the videos that are really upsetting. I do sometimes have a hard time not watching the videos where people are like, where there are gruesome injuries that are caught on video. Like, I don't know why I can't not watch those videos, but I don't watch anything related to animals. Like, it's just like, I don't feel obliged. I'm not going to be better equipped to solve the problem of meat markets dogs meat markets in parts of the world by watching videos of them being killed in a meat market. Like, that's not for me. And that might be motivating for other people. And that might be a good strategy for some organizations, but it's not the thing that has me take action. And so I don't watch those things and I hide the people who share those things, or unfollow them. And so I really make conscious decisions about what it is. And I think some people might say that I'm like creating a bubble for myself, but like, why am I not allowed to create my own bubble? I do in my home with who I let into my home. I get to create my own environment here. Why would it be different with social media? I don't have any obligation to watch terrible stuff. Like, I just don't.
Yeah. So I'll get to the questions I ask everybody. The first one is, what's the moment in your life when you realized you were going to be called to animal advocacy?
Yeah, well, of course, I knew you were going to ask this question, so I've been thinking about it. And it's not a super happy story, but I can tell you it's my animating thing. And I wish that I had thought to get a picture so I could show you about. But I was in the Peace Corps. I think you know that. I served in Mongolia for a little under 2 years. And in Mongolia, I became, for lack of a better term, the crazy dog lady. And it starts, as it always does, with one single dog. It's a puppy that somebody found during training. And I wound up adopting her and took her to my site. Her name was Hoshor, which is a, like a stuffed fried, like dumpling, like our meat. It's almost like a pupusa kind of actually. So stuffed with meat, rolled out, fried, delicious. It started my whole trend of naming pets after food, which has gone on for a long time. I had a Triscuit and a Cheddar and a Ham Bone. But Hosher, she's my best bud. She's the only person in my town who spoke English. I lived in this village of about 1,500 people, about 800 miles away from the capital, in a yurt. So she kept me warm at night. She was my protector. She waited outside of my school while I was teaching and walked with me everywhere. My boon companion. And then the following spring, I wound up adopting a second dog, Susie, who had a bum foot. So I had these two dogs. And then the first dog went into heat, got knocked up, had four puppies. So I had six dogs. And then I moved to a different town. This one was in the Gobi Desert. And as I moved in, a dog who had belonged to some previous volunteers adopted us, Sandy. So that was seven dogs. And then another dog showed up. She was eight. And then 3 days later had eight puppies. It was 16 dogs. And then one day, another puppy showed up, like just totally tried to weasel its way into my dog family as though I wouldn't notice. I'd never seen this dog before. So I wound up having 17 dogs and I was using all of my salary to buy food for the animals. Like my house is like Wild Kingdom because there were just dogs in and out all the time. It was not great. It was not super sustainable. But also, you know, Mongolians have very different relationship with dogs than we do. And there are huge populations of roaming dogs all over. People have their own pet dogs that are like guard dogs. But because there's no access to spay neuter, there are just these populations of dogs everywhere. And in that second town, in fact, I mean, that rabies is a concern in Mongolia, but also people would go to Russia and buy these very large purebred dogs like Great Danes and Rottweilers and German Shepherds, have them for a small time in their homes and then turn them out to the street where they were then interbreeding with the local dog population. So there were some very, very large semi-feral dogs roaming in packs all over town and they would get really aggressive. And so people would like have sticks. They'd walk around with sticks to like, it was like the Hound of the Baskervilles. And so it was a safety concern. And I had been told that the government strategy for controlling the dog population was that they would send out hunters. And so I put collars on my dogs. Everybody knew they were my dogs. But one day I came home from work and my dogs weren't there, which was weird, but I thought they might have been off wandering around. And so I decided to take my garbage out to the garbage, like sort of dump area. And I noticed that there was blood on the snow and realized that in fact, all of my dogs had been shot and killed. And the way that the government did it is that they would have a bounty and the dogs, you know, it was like 25 cents a dog. And so I got to the garbage area anyway, and all of my dogs were there and they were dead. And it was just as terrible as you can imagine. They had been, you know, my best friends, and I really, it was devastating. And my initial reaction was just cold fury because I was just so distraught. But then, you know, I thought, well, God, I got to do something about this. And my dream was to go back to Mongolia, to kidnap a veterinarian, to go back to Mongolia, neuter all of the dogs I could. And I still would like to do that someday. And in fact, I had just started the planning process to get a project together to go to Mongolia, because it turns out I actually know people now who might be able to help me with that. And I don't have to kidnap anyone, which is great. And then one of my colleagues from Peace Corps, somebody in my Peace Corps group, is actually a veterinarian down in Oregon. She's like, you don't have to kidnap me, I'll go with you. And so it occurred to me that I could like do that. But of course there's still a lot of work to be done in this country as well. And so it's Susie and Hosher. It was those dogs that had me thinking. I'm animated by service to them and their memory, and to do the, like, it just was so clear to me that that was the thing I should be doing. So I started managing volunteers and then wound up getting a job managing volunteers in an animal shelter and was like, that was it. And so every day, Susie and Hosher, my girls that I do my work for, and that was 1997. 98 when they were killed. It's a long time ago. Yeah.
Yeah. I wish I had some tissues.
Yeah. Sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah. No, I mean, I was a part of the project doing work in Puerto Rico on HSUS. We know we over the
course. That must have felt really good.
It was amazing. It was amazing. And there, I mean, it was just extraordinary. But because of that work, you know, I met all of these people doing spay neuter work all over. And in fact, that I mentioned doing a training in Nepal, when I went there, like coming up on 3 years ago, I presented at the Asia for Animals conference, and there were people in the room doing work for street dogs in Mongolia. And certainly my experience in Mongolia is also the thing that has me, that had me think that I wanted to be involved in doing work around compassion fatigue, because that experience was so traumatizing, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
That I didn't realize when I first started doing this work, I didn't realize how just over, like how much I was experiencing compassion fatigue in my work in sheltering. Cause I was a volunteer manager. Like what trauma was I experiencing in my work? Like none. Right. And so I went to this conference to learn about compassion fatigue. And I walked in thinking like, I mean, I'm a volunteer manager. I'm going to learn. I'm going to get all this good stuff. I want to be able to share it with people. It's going to be great. I can't wait. And I like was a disaster. I cried the entire workshop. I was bawling, and not like, I mean, I was bawling, thinking about and realizing the impact that experience with my dogs had on me. And so it was, that is sort of the animating thing for me with compassion fatigue, is that I think, I mean, that was a really, you know, shocking and horrifying and unusual sort of situation that I was in the Peace Corps, but we have experienced loss and have grief with animals all the time. And so many of us just have such a hard time. Like I really think it's possible to do this work without suffering. And if there's a way for me to give people the tools and strategies to try to minimize that, to take care of themselves, like I want them to be in it for the long haul. Like I don't want people to come and burn out and have to exit the field. Like I want to be able to leverage their experience. And we've gotten so much better at every part of this work that we do in animal welfare, like every part of it, from, you know, from the enrichment for the animals and veterinary care while they're in shelters to keeping pets in homes, like all the things that we do in this work, we've gotten so much better at doing, but it doesn't matter to me how well people do their jobs if they're miserable while they do it. And there are a lot of people who really suffer. And so if there are ways to give people tools to think about this in a different way so that they can really thrive in this one life that they've got, so they can be of service to animals and experience all the joy that there is in the world, And to even enjoy their own animals, right? Sometimes they're so overwhelmed with work, they don't even get to just like spend time with their own pets and reconnect with the thing that called them to do this work in the first place. And it's just, it's heartbreaking to me. So the more I can have the conversation and the more strategies we can provide to people to really think about how they can thrive in this work, then I'm going to just keep having the conversation. But I owe it to those dogs for sure.
Well, I'm with you in Mongolia. If you, you know, need somebody who doesn't at all have any veterinary experience other than giving my own cats vaccinations, I'll be there.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah, it was, it was a pretty cool moment to realize.
What do they speak in Mongolia?
Mongolian.
Is it like?
It's actually, it's a Turkic language. It's related. It's Turkic and also, and like it's also, I think, distantly related to Korean, but it's also, it was the basis for Klingon.
Oh, wow.
So it's pretty hard language. It's pretty hard language to learn.
I have not, none of my language studies would help with that, but.
No, and I was fluent in Spanish when I went there. And so none of my Spanish or none of my language training was very helpful there either. So, but I know people who know people, there. And so I'll let you know. I had just started really thinking about what that would look like and trying to put a plan together when the pandemic hit. And so it'll happen. It'll just be a little bit longer.
Okay. So what's the deal with animals?
That's the harder question. What is the deal with animals and why do we, why it's amazing to me how this thing that calls us to want them in our lives and to be around them, has us put up with all of the inconvenience that happens sometimes and all the effort. I think about, you know, I identify as a strong cat and dog person. I am not biased toward one or the other. And that seems to not be a really popular space. People really have strong feelings about one species over the other. But I am solidly with a foot in both camps. But cats, God, I love them. But also they can be a real pain in the butt, right? And so I have a coworker who has not ever had cats, but works with a bunch of cat lovers. And she said to me, she's like, you know, none of what you say about cats makes me ever want one. they sound like a real pain in the ass. And I'm like, they are. And I wouldn't change it for the world. And it's funny. Like I go out of my way to be very conscientious about what I allow in my life and the inconveniences I create for myself. And my animals are one of them that I wouldn't change for the world. And though the satisfaction that I get from my interactions with them and to provide a good and fulfilling life for them seems to be worth all of the pain in the butt. But it's especially good when Barley isn't reactive on leash. That makes it a lot better. That's the deal with animals. I don't know. They have these incredible powers over us that call people in this very deep and really profoundly impactful way. And here we are doing what we need to do for them and allowing ourselves to suffer. And so the deal with animals is that I don't think they want us to suffer for them. And I hope that we can figure out how to do this in a way that sustains us and defeats our soul as we serve them.
Thank you very much for our chat today.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Happy to do it.
That was Hillary Hager, the Vice President of Outreach, Engagement, and Training at the Humane Society of the United States. You can find out more about Hillary and her work at humanepro.com.
So what do you think is the deal with animals?
If you enjoyed this show and have any questions or comments about this episode or about the podcast in general, go to thedealwithanimals.com and leave me a message. This is also a great place to go if you're interested in being a guest or have an idea for a series or episode. And don't forget to follow and review wherever you listen to your podcast, as it helps us become more visible to other listeners. I'm your host, Marika Bell. I'd like to thank Kai Stranskoff for the theme music and Natasha Matsart for help with editing. You can see links to guest book recommendations, as well as their websites and affiliated organizations, in the show notes and at thedealwithanimals.com. Thank you for joining me as we try to answer the question, what's the deal with animals?
The Deal with Animals is part of the iROAR Animal Podcast Network.